For the work session.
So I'm going to call the House Interim Committee on Education for Wednesday, January 8th, to order. And what we're going to do today, folks, is to work our way through some legislative concepts, and then after each one, hopefully have a discussion if necessary, and then a vote for them to be introduced as committee bills. Just a reminder again that if you have cell phones in the audience, they affect the audio system here and make it difficult for people in Argentina to listen clearly to what we're saying here today.
Only if they listen on Wikipedia. Closed today.
So I'm going to... Wait, it's a real peanut gallery today, isn't there? So the order in which we intend to take these are LC 290, then LC 252, and then 253, and then 291. So I'm going to open a public hearing on LC 290, relating to lead. Is Gail Shibley in the audience? Welcome.
Happy New Year. My name is Gail Shibley. I'm the Administrator for Environmental Public Health in the Oregon Health Authority. It's a delight to be with you today. I was asked by your esteemed committee administrator if I could make myself available to you. I wanted to provide the committee some of the materials related to lead and the concern, the health concerns around lead exposure, lead poisoning that we have available. Just as general background about what is lead, why do we care about it, what's the risk, and what can be done. Happy to...
Mr. Chair.
Representative Hoffman?
May I interrupt Gail before she takes another breath?
If
you would refresh us on what we did, I think in 2009, the Human Services Committee, we had a lead bill. If you could just kind of remind us what we did there, too, and how that might fit in with this.
Sure.
That'd be great.
Sure.
Thanks.
Representative Huffman, happy to do that. So the LC, our reading of the LC, requires my agency and likely my part of the agency to provide specific information up on our website. And it's listed there for you. I won't read it for you. I will share with you, as I did with Ms. Cox, that we are in the final stages of making what we hope are some user-friendly tweaks to our website that actually cover and implement this very nice list of information that we think is helpful to specifically to schools. I think perhaps the administrator or Representative Conger, if Vice Chair Conger, if he is available, can share some of his great work during this interim around lead exposure and schools. Representative Huffman asked specifically about a bill that was enacted a couple sessions ago. It's affectionately known as Repair, Renovation, and Painting. And I think I did not actually bring one of those brochures with you, but that was a bill that allowed, under kind of a cooperative federalism construct common between the federal government and state governments, allowed the state of Oregon to take primary enforcement responsibility for a federal regulation under TSCA, the Toxic Substances Control Act, which is overseen by the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency. That is a federal requirement that that in certain child-occupied facilities, and child-occupied facilities is defined under that federal law and therefore under our state law as 0 to 6. So that if you have a daycare center, for example, or say you had a school, a public school or a private school, that also offered pre-K, for example, or even kindergarten, if they're under 6, then they would come under this regulation of, and that requires, in brief, when different types of repair, renovation, or painting projects are done, either external or internal, that that work be overseen by someone who has been trained by an accredited trainer. And my agency accredits the trainer and accredits the curriculum that these trained individuals have, and to try to make sure that child-occupied facilities are safe and are renovated, repaired, or painted safely. What research shows is that those are the activities that most likely disturbs lead-based paint, and therefore most likely is a key exposure pathway for lead-based paint in young children. The reason that I can't speak for the federal government, but it makes sense to us as public health professionals that the rule speaks to 0 to 6, because that's the age of child where lead exposure is indeed the most key. Not to take away from the concern about lead exposure in you know, 7, 8, 9, 10, all the way through adults, but it is during that key time of human development when exposure to lead has been seen, and I think the materials I provided you kind of reflect that. There is identified a lifetime reduction in IQ and resulting concern around special education, developmental delays, certainly loss to future potential earnings, etc. So that's what the RRP rule does, and that's what our authority under that rule covers. It does not per se cover public schools or private schools, but K through 1 through 12 does not per se come under the aegis of this new federal rule. So I did just want to share with the committee that that we certainly support getting information out about the concern around lead, about the adverse health effects from exposure to lead, how to recognize hazards, and information about how to safely paint or renovate to prevent exposure. And that's why we are making changes or finalizing changes to our website to more clearly and I hope user-friendly provide that information. That's identified as required under LC 290. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Perfect timing. Questions?
Does anybody, thank you, Gail. Appreciate it. Does anybody else wish to testify?
Actually, I do have a question.
Okay.
Do you have a specific comment on the legislative concept itself? Do you think it is something that we should be moving forward at this time? Is it something that needs more work? Is it ready to go?
Mr. Co-Chair Wingard and Co-Chair Gelser, I certainly defer to the wisdom of the committee. As I'm sharing with you, we are moving forward as though this bill were already law. We think it's a good idea. You don't need to convince us of the appropriateness of doing it. I'm not sure that it really requires it. Change in revising the statutes, but I appreciate the opportunity to get up here and to continue to talk about the concern around lead exposure. I think it's my understanding that there are some folks who may think that this does not go far enough. There are others who are concerned that doing more requires money, certainly within the confines of the very restrictive, you know, fiscal environment that we're in, and so this is a good deal financially speaking, and certainly from public health information. So we wanted to move forward with it. Long way to not be terribly responsive, but I wanted to appreciate the opportunity to speak about lead exposure. It is real. It is dangerous. It does have lifelong consequences, and appreciate the leadership that Rep. Conger and others in the legislature have shown around childhood exposures.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Denver.
Just following up on that, I really appreciate this pamphlet on protecting kids from lead paint, a guide for child care providers. So is this the kind of thing that you think would go up on this clearing? Is it already on your website somewhere?
Representative Denver, I don't know that we've scanned that specific one, but if we don't, if we have not yet, we certainly can and should and will. We actually have a, I only brought couple screenshots for my use here, but it specifically identifies child care and schools as one of the areas, and so that's where that would go.
Mm-hmm. Just following up, Ms. Chair, you know, I would think that the you know, the issue of lead paint in private daycare centers, you know, care centers that are in people's homes, that would be a serious problem. And, you know, the more that we could make the providers aware of that problem, the better. Do we already have a process for that, to put that up on their radar screen? Is it part of the certification or the oversight process that we do with private daycare centers? Because that, I think, might do some real good if that were the case.
Co-Chair Wingard and Representative Dembrow, thank you for the question. Let me try to be quick about a very important issue. There are about 1,000 certified child care facilities in the state, about 800 or 900 certified family child care homes, and about 4,000 registered family child care homes in the state. And they're all kind of regulated differently depending on the size and scope and various definitions. So the answer depends on which category you're in, is the quick answer. Let me put it this way, I think more could be done in terms of providing information during inspections. Right now, my little program provides some of the environmental samples and help with taking environmental samples, but in terms of inspection protocols or swabs or, you know, other ways to really identify, is there a problem, and if there is, what are the options to deal with it? There's not much going on there. And as I said, there are literally thousands and thousands of these homes around the state, oftentimes doing really important work, mm-hmm. doing the best of their ability. Mm-hmm. And, you know, our focus is simply on trying to make sure that the kids are not being inadvertently exposed to lead during that period.
Representative Frederick.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you very much for this. I'd be very remiss if I didn't mention the Josiah Hill Clinic. He began 30 years ago talking about this issue and trying to get the testing done in North and Northeast Portland, and they continue to do this, and it's an incredibly important aspect. So thank you for doing this, and thank whoever's expanding that. I understand you're part of that effort. Thank you very, very much. This is an important piece for the kids that are out there and dealing with lead paint, so thanks again.
Yeah, well, thank you very much. I'm going to close the public hearing on LC 290 and open a work session on LC 290. Representative Conger?
Mr. Chair, I move we introduce LC 290 dated 12/16/2011 as a committee measure.
Representative Conger seeks to introduce LC 290 dated 12/16/11 as a committee measure. Again, this vote does not constitute an endorsement for or against the bill. It's simply we'll introduce the bill as an education committee bill for the February 2012 session. Any discussion? Do we need to call a roll? Is there any objection? So ordered. So I'll close the work session on LC 290. Oh, by the way, that motion passed. What are we going to do next? So let's open a public hearing on LC 252. Chris Savoli. Chris Savoli from the College Board and Matt Markey.
Good afternoon, co-chairs and members of the committee. My name is Chris Zavoli, and I come to you as the Senior Director of State Government Relations in my 26th year with the College Board. I'm here today to represent the College Board and its mission: excellence, and equity. Mostly, or more importantly, I'm here to represent students who don't know they can go to college, because I was one myself. I'm in strong support of this bill because it addresses the inequity in AP course offerings across high schools in the state. As you know, AP is a college course taught in high school. And there's strong research confirming the premise of this bill, that students who take AP, and you all have the handout, are more likely to go to college and to graduate. So just take a quick look at the colored side. I've actually shared this with the committee before, but I just wanted to refresh your memory on its importance, the importance of students who take AP and their likelihood of actually finishing college in 4 years or less. And it shows you those with no AP, 29% higher, with one AP, 45% higher, and with two AP courses, it's actually 61% higher. If you flip this over, on the back side, and this speaks again to our mission of equity and excellence, looking at the subgroups, just a reminder that the exam score for AP is from 1 to 5. The College Board recommends 6 semester units of college credit for a score of 3, 4, or 5. And here in Oregon, you have a uniform policy in your universities to give 6 units across your public universities. And that's not all states have that. So what does this chart say? It simply is telling you 5-year college graduation rates for the different subgroups. So let's take African-American students. Those who score 3, 4, or 5 in an AP exam have a 28% higher graduation rate. And if you look at the far right, those who took a course but not the exam, just a 16% higher rate. So that was separate and independent research done for the College Board. I think one of the reasons that AP is so important for students as far as going to college is that by taking a college course in high school, it often gives them the confidence that they can be college bound. And I think that's really the power of advanced placement. There's been considerable growth, you should know, in students taking AP in Oregon, but equity is still a concern. I actually looked at your 235 high schools and find that only 60 high schools offer 4 or more AP courses. And only 24.5% of public high school graduates take at least one AP exam. And that compares to about 31% of public high school graduates nationally. Although the percentage of students taking an exam really has grown rapidly in the last 10 years, there's still a concern about equity. The bill is going to target high schools in Oregon, as I said, offering fewer than 4 classes, and proposes that they are contacted annually and provided information about AP. And the College Board would provide this data by high school to the Department of Ed. And they would be the ones who would then communicate with the schools as far as how to go about starting an AP course. You should also know Education Commission for the States, the American Council on Education, and the NGA all recommend this very policy for AP statewide. The state of Oregon has shown its strong commitment, I think, to college readiness by paying for PSAT for 10th graders. And one of the good things about schools giving PSAT is that every school has an online tool, a free online tool called AP Potential, that helps them identify students who are likely to be successful in all 33 of our AP courses. So it's a way you can find a critical mass if you want to start a course. And currently, only 23% of your schools even access that tool. So this, I think, will really contribute to the investment that you've made already in PSAT and college readiness. And you should know that similar bills have passed in other states, and there's never needed to be a fiscal note, and some states have received foundation funding to support professional development in support of this equity bill.
Co-chairs, members of the committee, Matt Markey representing the College Board. I'll be very brief. Chris did a great job of explaining what the bill does. But one thing that from last session that passed, Senate Bill 252, Senator Hass worked very closely on, was a mandate that required all schools to offer advanced type of classes by the year of 2014. This is one way to identify some schools where AP at least is not being offered. And as Chris mentioned, in states where this has passed, the College Board has found some foundation dollars to help for professional development, to help train teachers, to help find ways to better use AP potential, like she mentioned, and to help bridge that gap before 2014 gets here, when the mandate goes into place, so that we can bring these types of classes into those schools. So I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Questions? Co-Chair Gelser.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I've raised this question to Representative Comp and Representative Huffman. And talking to some folks around the state about this bill, I think people are excited about the idea of making sure that students have access to college preparatory courses. And we do that in a lot of ways in Oregon, advanced placement courses, international baccalaureate. I know certainly in our community we have students earning college credit by cross-enrolling in Lynn Benton Community College or Oregon State University. And I just wonder if you would be open to an amendment to this bill that really would focus on that overall goal of access to college preparation. So rather than focusing solely on the College Board product of advanced placement, talk about college preparatory classes or college credit-bearing courses. And that would allow those districts that have chosen a different path, like IB or the expanded options that we've worked so hard on in the legislature, to really get credit from us and in those reports for what they are doing to make sure that their kids are prepared for college and ready to succeed in the same way that you've promoted here today.
Co-Chair Gelser, I'll take a shot at this first, and I think what you're saying makes a lot of sense. One thing that we've struggled with here, and we've been working with the Department of Education on, is whether or not this is going to have a fiscal on it. And I think in the time that we're in and with the budget problems we have, you know, fiscals are a definite concern. And with it being even narrowed to AP at this point, we're still having those conversations about whether or not there will be a fiscal on the bill. And I think as we expand that, then also expands the fiscal. And I don't know, I think a lot of schools, and I don't want to speak for everybody, but I think a lot of schools have a relationship with their community college where they're talking about dual enrollment, and that's taking place. I can't speak to IB. I'm not an expert in IB. Obviously, the College Board is AP. But even with us, you know, offering up all of the research from the College Board on AP about these schools, we're still having that conversation about a fiscal. And I would hate to see something that would, I'm hopeful that we can alleviate that. I don't know if we can or not. But if we add to that, and then that also drives up the fiscal, and none of this happens, I think that would be a detriment. So,
can I follow up? Thank you. I guess, and I appreciate what you're saying. Anytime we're going into a short session, nobody wants to be surprised at the big fiscal coming from any place. But from an efficiency point of view, it's hard for me to imagine why it would make sense to have the department contact a school district that's adopted an international baccalaureate program or that has a large number of kids that are getting college credits in school through advanced courses that they've worked out in a collaborative arrangement with their local community college or university. So, I mean, I think that fiscal issue goes both ways, and it makes me, just to be really candid, it always makes me nervous to put a particular product in statute, and the idea completely makes sense, but I just don't know that the legislature should be in the business of endorsing a product in statute, a specific brand.
Let me just say, I think that's an excellent question, and I think IB is an excellent program, and I know you have a lot of dual enrollment also in the state, but it really does have to do with cost, because you can introduce AP in a school for nothing. And I can bring teachers in to testify to that. You cannot do that with IB. It's a much more costly program, as are the exams. So that's one of the reasons we really didn't want to tie it to IB. IB is a great program, but it's very expensive to introduce and very expensive to pay for. I think the exams are up to almost $700. With AP, our exam is $80. And you can choose to just offer one course, even to get started with one course. But I do understand the point that you're making. And maybe what we should do is provide more of the financial and I think it would be a good idea with this bill to eliminate the IB schools from being contacted, and we could do that. and, you know, extract those first, but they tend to be in the much more affluent schools. And the heart of this bill is to reach the low-income schools and the schools with great diversity.
And you don't think there's a way to do that without endorsing a particular brand in state statute?
Madam Co-Chair, there may be. We're willing to have those conversations, definitely.
Representative Denbrough?
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Chris, it's great to
see you.
You mentioned that about 60 schools offer fewer than four AP.
No, 60 schools offer more, four or more out of 235.
Okay.
So you have all the rest that offer
rest.
3, 2, 1, and the majority who offer not even one course.
Right. Have you given us the list of schools?
I have it, and I'd be happy to share that.
That would be great.
Great.
My assumption would be that the real challenge is with the rural schools and the small schools, right? And so there, you know, in terms of the resources that are available to those schools, we may need to look at ways of grouping students together through distance learning or something like that. So what would be some examples of resources that, you know, the more far-flung schools could take advantage of?
Well, one of the things that's excellent about AP is that on our website there's something called AP Central, and it brings together the I'm not sure the exact number of AP teachers this year, but it's extraordinary across the country. I think it's about 100,000. And they have mentoring available to new AP teachers. They walk them through the curriculum. Again, AP is a curriculum that we have developed with high school and college faculty in every subject. So there's a lot of support for the teacher. There's professional development, and we have a representative in the state of Washington who actually has done extensive work with rural schools throughout the Pacific Northwest and has some very good models for working with rural schools, and I'd be happy to bring her in if you want to hear more about that.
Great. Thank you.
Representative Hoffman?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Matt and I have talked. You know, one of the reasons for this bill, and it's kind of continuing from work on the Online Learning Task Force, is to ensure that remote rural schools are giving their kids the opportunities. And so I didn't want a large fiscal derailing, you know, further possibilities. Several years ago, this committee worked on the bill that we referred to as mandatory 10th grade testing, and you know, Representative Kopp and I did a lot of work on that, and we had talked about, you know, the possibility of, technically, the train had already left the station. We said, you know, maybe it should have been 8th or 9th grade mandatory testing so that we really are ahead of the curve, so that if the point is to really get involved in the student's education and help them and say, okay, you need some remediation here and here, but you're doing very well here, so let's accelerate you, or whatever the need is for the individual student. I'm not convinced that on a student-by-student basis in Oregon we are getting close to accomplishing that one-on-one counseling that I had envisioned coming out of that. So this is just another tool in the toolbox, if you will, to help. And in my assumption was that at one point we had mentioned online, and it was not connected with the Online Learning Task Force portion of what we traditionally think of as online schools in Oregon providing, you know, K-8 or K-12 content, but it was more from a broadband delivery aspect. And then anecdotally, I was in a high school education meeting in one of my counties 2 months ago, and I was sitting with a student at my round of eight, and before the meeting got started, we were just visiting, and I said, so, you're a student here? Where are you graduating, senior? I said, oh, okay, you plans to go on to college, or what are your plans? Yeah, I want to go on to college. I said, great. You know, do you have some AP classes, some dual credit, you know, anything to kind of help you get a jump start heading down that direction? She kind of looked at me with a blank expression, said no, and I said, really, what, was it ever offered and you just didn't take advantage of it? She, nobody ever talked to me about those programs being available to give me a jump start. I thought, you know, how sad. But, it, you know, one of the rural counties, and here was a senior, and from talking to her, she seemed to be sharp enough that she could have taken advantage had they been offered. And so that was, you know, all of that to say that's kind of why I want to, the purpose of the bill, kind of maybe a start for something. And personally, and I'll let Representative Comp speak to it, personally, I'm open to others, you know, having two community colleges represented in my district. I work with them a lot to make sure that they are working with the high schools in my district with full-blown programs for dual credits, and every year we're getting more and more graduating seniors that get their diploma 1 week, and the next week they get their AA. And so those things are encouraging to see happen. I'd like to accelerate that in any way we could. If we get a big fiscal on something and we get bogged down, we won't be able to accomplish anything. So I guess my goal has always been I'd like to have half of something rather than all of nothing.
Briefly, very briefly. Thanks for your presentation, Chris. I have to take and say that for every rule, there's always an exception. And Woodburn School District is an IB school, and we're probably one of the highest poverty schools in the state. And the reality is, when you want good teaching and good learning, you invest your dollars wisely, no matter what the programs are. And I really don't have any comments about this bill draft at this time. I think it is incredibly important. I agree with my colleague, Representative Huffman, that the struggle we have is that information doesn't come soon enough. I've had the same kind of conversations he had with students. I always ask them, well, what do you, you know, what'd you get on your PSAT or your ACT? And they go, I don't know. And so there is not an awareness, but yet, on the other hand, I would say that Oregon has the highest ratio of 250 students per one counselor at high school level to see all those children. And so there's multiple reasons why this information doesn't get into parents' hands and those things. So we got a long ways to go and lots of work to do. So, Mr. Chair, I think we ought to just do it.
Let me just say one thing to make you feel better. The student council ratio in California is 1,000 to 1.
Well,
with rock bottom.
I always say, I'm glad I'm not in California.
I know. Just one more reason. I did want to say one thing about online as far as the teacher. And one of the things the College Board has invested in the last 2 years is providing online learning to teachers who want to start a course. So that's another opportunity that is available to the rural schools.
So I'm going to close the public hearing on LC 252 and open a work session on LC 252. Representative Huffman.
Mr. Chair, I would move that the Education Committee take on LC 252 as a committee bill.
So Representative Huffman has made a motion to introduce LC 252 dated 12-9-11 as a committee measure.
Any objection? Any discussion? Motion passes.
I'm going to close the work session on LC 252. And open a public hearing on LC 253. Cindy Hunt.
Good afternoon. Cindy Hunt, Government Legal Affairs Manager for the Department of Education. I'm handing out a couple of documents, but before you get those, I want to put LC 253 into the context. This is the next step in mandate relief. You may recall last session, you passed Senate Bill 800. And Senate Bill 800 eliminated 28 different mandates. The State Board of Education since that time has implemented Senate Bill 800 and has eliminated another group of rules that were associated with it. The first document that you have there is a summary of the mandate relief efforts to this point. So this effort started before the 2011 session. And to this point, we've eliminated roughly 150 different state mandates. So these were statutes, rules, policies, etc. So, going to the back of this page, the projects that are pending right now, just to touch on them, are the Division 22 rule revision, which is approximately 65 different rules and reports. And you'll probably be hearing more about this as the discussion about the achievement compacts and the OEIB is started, because one of the things that's mentioned in that is an incentive, if you will, that districts that enter into achievement compacts will have their Division 22 reporting waived. We're also examining all of Division 22 to see what makes sense. So that's a big project that we're undertaking. But LC 253 has an additional 10 mandates that are in statute to be eliminated. Now, Senate Bill 800 was the low-hanging fruit on the tree. These were obsolete. Senate LC 253 is moving up the tree, so to speak. And what I mean by that is that some of the mandates in 253 are relatively recent, from as recent as the 2007 legislative session. So there are still, in the interest of transparency, supporters to some of these. So in the second page of what I gave you, kind of in plain speak, I went over what the 10 mandates are, and I'm going to go over those briefly right now. So the first one is to eliminate the District Best Business Practices Advisory Committee. This committee has been put on hold, not just for this biennium, but last biennium it was also put on hold. When it was up and operating, the cost associated with it was roughly $800,000 a biennium, which was taken out of the state school fund. As mentioned here, the state, the legislature suspended this activity for this biennium, so that $800,000 is in the state school fund and being distributed to districts to go into the classroom. The second one is an elimination of the collection of data and the reporting of physical education minutes and facilities. But to be clear on this, this is not an elimination of the requirements on districts to offer PE or to offer specific instructional time. This is just on the data reporting of the facilities. So this information has been reported since 07, and we have that information. It's also been reported back to the legislature. And so as far as the facilities go, we're not seeing a lot of change. So it was felt that this is less useful than it once was, in, frankly, in 2008 and 2009. The third one on the list is in the area of the state food standards, not the federal food standards. This was from a bill also in 07, and the bill imposed onto districts requirements for snacks that they offer in schools, vending machines, that kind of thing. Again, we're not affecting that requirement in this bill. It's the reporting by districts to the department. So what this does is the report says that districts are supposed to declare themselves compliant or not compliant and then report that information to us. So I asked our staff, how often does someone ask for one of these reports? Well, they were asked for once back in 08. Do we have anyone that's collecting those? Well, no, because we're giving a general fund to implement this. You know, and in this area also, our folks that work in the federal food area, those are all federal funds, so this is a state requirement, so those folks aren't working on this. So that's why we identified this one, not the underlying, again, requirement, but the report. The fourth one on the list is a requirement on the State Board of Education when they get a charter school application that's been rejected by a school district, they are mandated to mediate between the applicant and the school district. This requirement's been in place since the original charter school law was enacted 11 years ago, and we've had roughly more than 25 mediations. Only two that I'm aware of were successful. Mainly, the reason is that by the time they get to us, they're already pretty hostile towards each other. It's not the time to mediate.
And so I asked our staff how much we contract for the mediators, and then as needed, we, you know, assign them to these districts and so forth. So I asked our staff how much did we expend last biennium on mediations? Roughly $29,000. And that doesn't include school district time, the applicant's time, and often districts and applicants bring their attorneys to these mediations. The fifth one...
Cindy, before you move on... So if this is repealed, what then happens?
Yeah,
there's no mediator. They just move on to the next step?
Yeah, they would just move on. They would, and again, these would be those applicants who decide to appeal to the State Board of Education for sponsorship. So what would happen is we would review their application, you know, for sponsorship, and they would go through the State Board sponsorship process.
And there just wouldn't be an attempt at mediation.
Right, exactly. Exactly, yeah. The next one is around the requirement. Right now, the State Board of Education adopts a list of textbooks. If a school district wants to adopt a textbook that's not on the list, they notify the State Board of Education of that adoption. Under this, they would not need to notify the State Board of Ed that they were doing that. However, the State Board is directed to establish guidelines and criteria for when they could do this. So it would be a step further. Because I know one of the concerns sometimes that comes up is, you know, we want districts to still be adhering to state standards and, you know, general principles when they're adopting textbooks. So the adoption of these guidelines that's in the draft should address that. The sixth, seventh, and eighth one on the list are elimination of Arbor Week activities, History of Oregon Statehood Week, and Women in History Week. Now, I like trees, Oregon history, and women, but that doesn't necessarily mean we should have, you know, a week specifically designated where districts are told to set aside instructional hours and curriculum and so forth. And so, you know, with this, it would give districts more flexibility to celebrate these things. And again, we're not affecting these items, Oregon history, for example, being part of the Oregon standards and curriculum, or achievements of women in history being part of the standards. What we're doing is eliminating the very specific week and the very specific requirements that say you have to spend this many hours on this week. You know, and so, for example, you know, the week of May 2nd is History of Oregon Week, as opposed to, say, February 14th, the state's birthday. So the districts would have flexibility.
Again, just to ask, are these the only three examples of this in statute where we mandate that something be taught for at a specific time for a certain, like this, of a week or a day? Are these the three that exist in statute, or are there more?
Co-Chair Wingard, it's the only three that I can think of off the top of my head, but let me get back to you. I do know there's a specific requirement that school districts teach the Oregon and U.S. Constitutions, but I do not believe that is for a specific week. That's just generally.
Okay.
On the back of the sheet, number nine is the elimination of a report to you on courses on family life, HIV, and sex ed. So this report is based on annual, basically those Division 22 assurances that's been suspended for this year. So this report, I think, is going to be kind of shallow this year. But again, this is not a report that we're being asked for. It's been around, I think, for about 10 years, 15 years. So that's why it's on here. Again, this would not affect the requirements on districts to offer health and sex ed and HIV and so forth, education in the schools. Finally,
Representative Gelser.
So in the language that's being repealed, it repeals the report that the department gives to the legislature. It does not appear to eliminate the report that the school district gives to the department. So is that the mechanism to continue to hold school districts accountable for the... I mean, that's relatively new legislation that we were able to get age-appropriate, medically accurate sex education in all of our schools. They would still be held accountable to that and have to substantiate that to the department.
Right. Co-Chair Gelser, there's... in the statutes, there's a statute that talks about and describes appropriate sex ed, HIV, etc. That statute isn't affected. There's also a rule that implements that, and that's part of Division 22. That rule hasn't been repealed. It's still there. What that means is that if someone believes that their district is not implementing that particular rule,
They can file a complaint with their district. They go through their local process, but they can file a complaint with us. Ultimately, if we find that they're not adhering to that and the district does not rectify it, we can withhold state school fund dollars. Now, what the report comes in, the assurance report kind of a thing that I've mentioned, is that right now districts each year sign off and say, we're adhering to that. That's the piece that's been suspended. It's not the underlying requirement. It's the reporting of the requirement. And it's not the underlying, like, complaint mechanism either, so.
And one quick follow-up.
Hello.
Thank you. So with the, this is more back to the suspension of the report on the Division 22 standards. How are families and community members notified of their ability to hold their school district accountable for these things by filing a complaint with the department?
Yeah.
How accessible is that process? For instance, if someone is concerned that the bullying policy is not being implemented correctly, or they are concerned that their child had a sex ed program that was not medically accurate, how would they know? Would their school district automatically tell them this, or would they need to be sophisticated enough to navigate the ODE website?
Co-Chair Gelser, it kind of varies from person to person. All districts should have a complaint mechanism that they've adopted by policy. Most districts will have that policy posted on their website, for example. I know that those districts, when I've had a question about what their policy is, I've been able to readily go and find it on their website. I haven't reviewed all 197 districts, but the ones I have, they have it. The parents that call us, and many do, generally speaking, we send them, you know, look for your district's complaint process. Here's our state level one. In more popular areas, such as harassment and bullying is one of our popular areas that we get contacted, we have like a two-page kind of front and back information sheet that talks about, you know, these are the places that you can go for relief, including complaints and, you know, if your child, if you feel child abuse in that area, you know, law enforcement, et cetera. So it kind of varies, you know, and some parents, frankly, are very sophisticated. They know very, very well how to, you know, launch a complaint against their districts. Some parents also don't want to do a formal complaint, frankly. They, you know, they don't want that kind of attention, or they don't want to pursue it, or, you know. So sometimes, you know, it's a matter of, you know, our staff kind of picking up the phone and saying, by the way, what's going on here? You know, kind of that informal mechanism, but it really varies from parent to parent, district to district.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Representative Denver.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Just following up on that, Cindy. So it sounds as if the reporting here is really kind of pro forma. Is that right? They're just checking a box? Is that essentially it? Or is there a narrative involved? And what does the department do to follow up if, let's say, a box is not checked? Or do schools ever say, we're not complying? Say a little more about what might be lost.
Co-Chair Wenger, Co-Chair Gelser, and Representative Dembro, thanks for that question. It varies. I mean, in some cases, it's a box. They check the box. In some cases, they submit, you know, background materials, you know. In some cases, they kind of have a list, and they sign at the bottom, you know. So it really kind of, like I said, varies. As far as do some districts, in answer to your question, do some districts, you know, self-report that they're not in compliance? Yes, they do. And it will, you know, vary as to which ones they're not in compliance with. Instructional hours right now is a big one. By way of example, I was trying to think, let's see, which other ones are kind of, the instructional hours is the most common one kind of by far right now. And as far as follow-up goes, at one point, the Department of Ed had, I think it was roughly about a dozen staff that did activities with local districts in addition to other duties, right? They would visit local districts to see if they were in compliance, pick up the phone, you know, answer questions, technical assistance, that kind of thing. That staff has primarily been moved to federal funds, or those positions have been eliminated. So now we have one staff person that's assigned to that. So there is not as much follow-up. So mainly the follow-up comes in when we get a complaint and, you know, and then the investigation and the writing of the order and that kind of thing. So there is a lot less follow-up than there once was. And again, primarily the reason for that is the shifting away from generally funded positions, state-funded, if you will, to federally funded positions. And when you do that, you need to do the federal activities. So that's the reason.
And so that's also prompting many of the things that are on this list. It's a reflection of that shifting away and the reality of the situation that we're in.
Representative Kahn?
Very briefly, who made the decisions or how were the decisions made of which reports would be suspended for this school year?
Chair Winger, Chair Gelser, Representative Comp, thanks for that question as well. The after the end of the last session, the Education Enterprise Steering Committee, which is a committee that consists of superintendents from around the state, Department of Education personnel, and other kind of local district folks, I think the governor's office also sits on that committee, they sat down and looked at additional reports to see, you know, what they felt should also be on the list. Other people added things to the list. Some people, you know, debated what should be on the list. I think that these things were identified because it was looked at as, you know, what is the value of these items still? You know, like in the case of, I'll give you the example of the Family Life, HIV, and Human Sexuality one. This isn't one that legislators are asking us for. For example, you know, it's not one that people in the public are asking us for. You know, we have other reports that we get that people do ask us for regularly. So those kinds of ones are not on the list. We also looked at, you know, what do we need to do to comply with federal law? So none of these are on the list, you know, because they're in extra, you know, to federal law. So that was the other part of this. So that's kind of how this list was come up, was, you know, adopted.
You have one more?
Oh, yes. How could I have forgotten? Number 10. this is the elimination of the mandate that school districts, as part of their reading instructional materials, must have phonics instruction. And the mandate is very specific. It's phonics must be included as part of reading instructional materials. Eliminating this, again, does not mean that school districts won't use phonics. Many districts use phonics. It's very appropriate. What it means, though, is that they'll have the flexibility to adopt reading materials that they believe are appropriate for their district.
Are there any other mandates like this in statute where we mandate a specific math, reading, writing, science teaching method or curriculum?
Co-Chair Winger, there were some others that were eliminated in Senate Bill 800. And I cannot think of any others that are specific.
So I guess the only thing I put out there is I'm not uncomfortable with this repeal, but if the notion is that we shouldn't be dictating something specific like this, I'd like to see everything that we're mandating like that together in one repeal bill.
Yeah. Co-Chair Winger, Co-Chair Gelser, and, you know, and I would anticipate in 2013 that you may see another mandate bill in front of you, you know, because as you go up the tree, you know, I mean, are there other things out there that, you know, you go, with the shift that we're doing, state-level policy and so forth, that they now should be on the list? Yes. Are there other specific things like this? Like I said, the ones that I'm thinking of, I believe, were all eliminated in Senate Bill 800. So
just one more look. I just like an assurance before the bill moves, assuming it does. But I mean, I'd like to know that we're not missing something else. I think if you're going to repeal one, it's a good opportunity to take them all out, because what would be the argument for one over another?
Right.
Representative Frederick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have one concern, and you need to help me work through this. It relates to number 5. And it's because of my history, I guess. A certain little town was taken over by a group of people in eastern Oregon many years ago, and they managed to put in their curriculum in the school and in the library a series of their curriculum was very different than anything that was available elsewhere in the state. This is the Antelope and the Rajneesh situation. Walk me through why this would not be available. Does not open the door to this kind of activity.
Yeah. Co-Chair Winger, Co-Chair Gelser, and Representative Frederick. Well, first of all, in that situation, those adoptions were probably religious-based, and we have all sorts of anti-discrimination laws and complaint mechanisms if a school district is endorsing a particular religion. So setting that aside, okay, as a mechanism. But this does not affect. You know, the other thing around this is that the textbooks that they would adopt would have to meet state standards. And so if they weren't meeting state standards, they would not be in compliance with state law. The other thing around this mandate, too, is that it just talks about the districts notifying the State Board of Ed. It doesn't say the State Board has to approve those textbooks, those additional textbooks that they're adopting. They're just notifying us, by the way, we're doing this. You know, so so I'm not sure that, you know, the level of, oversight is what people think it is that's there now, I think is how I would put it. But, you know, in direct response to your question on that particular issue, I would say that there's probably three things that would prevent it. It would be the religious discrimination kind of stuff going on, the state standards and the guidelines and criteria, you know, that's in the bill. So the criteria and then the guidelines that are the state board's told to adopt, you know, in response to the bill. So those would be the three.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Cindy, any idea, any calculation on the potential savings from the elimination of these 10?
Yeah. Chair Wingard, we are calculating that as I speak. And so, you know, right now I mentioned, you know, there's $800,000 from the district best business practices and then the $30,000 from charter mediation. So that's $830,000 roughly a biennium. Going down the list, I don't think others are going to be at that level. So, you know, roughly between $830,000 and $900,000 a biennium.
So nearly $1 million in potential.
Nearly.
Mostly,
yeah.
To the department?
Actually, a lot of these would save district time.
Right.
So, and you know, and like the mediation, when I say $30,000, that's a department cost. Those are, that does not include district time, and it does not include charter applicant time.
Right. So any number we end up with is actually just going to probably be the department side of the equation.
Co-Chair Winger, that's correct. Yes. And like I said, some of this is hard to estimate because, you know, going with the mediation example, a school district or a charter applicant has that expense. If they have a charter applicant, they reject it, you know. So it kind of varies from, you know, biennium to biennium, for example.
Questions? Cindy, thank you.
Thanks.
So I have Mel Rader on the testimony list.
Co-Chair Wingard, Co-Chair Gelser, members of the committee. My name is Mel Rader. I'm the co-director of Upstream Public Health, which is a nonprofit dedicated to improving the health of Oregonians. I'm here today to testify about some concerns we have about the LC 253, and in particular in two areas around the reporting for physical education, hours and facilities, and around the reporting on compliance with school nutrition standards at the local level. I want to clarify that the reporting requirements, which are in the statute now, require reporting of not only facilities but also the number of minutes of physical education that are provided to students. As mentioned before, the facilities don't often change. They don't often build a new gym or destroy an old gym, but the number of minutes have changed significantly during the economic recession. We've seen cutbacks in some school districts. We've seen, and some school districts have been in the position of adding classes, which is great. And we do have, you know, currently requirements in state law that for physical education hours to be put into effect in 2017. And data requirements are a very important piece for us to get to where we want to be in the year 2017. So I encourage you not to repeal 329.498 and 329.499, because we really do need to know the number of hours of PE that are offered this year and next year, and come up with a clear plan of where we're going to get to the requirements by 2017. As there's a considerable amount of scientific evidence now that points that physical education is a key component that boosts achievement. When physical education is integrated as a core part of the curriculum, we see graduation rates go up, absenteeism go down, grades go up. It's a core part of the curriculum that is important that we understand where we are now and where we want to get to. Second, I urge you not to weaken the school nutrition standards for the state. Current statute says the school boards will report on compliance with school nutrition standards, and that's an important part of tracking what's happening at the local level and ensuring compliance. I also mentioned that there are some changes, significant changes at the federal level on this year. The USDA will be writing federal rules around school nutrition standards, which were mandate in the national health care reform law. And so we will be seeing some changes in the next year or two around school nutrition standards, and it's important that we have that information available to know which school districts are meeting the standards and which aren't, and to make decisions in partnership with the federal government around transitioning into new school nutrition standards at the local level. Thank you very much for your time.
Questions? Thank you, sir. I don't have anybody else on the list. Does someone else want to testify on LC 253?
Mr. Chair?
Representative
Can I just ask a question? Actually, I should have asked it of Cindy. When the fiscal is determined for this, it would be good if it could be broken down initiative by initiative, right? So we could see we see the $800,000, but, you know, there's kind of cost-benefit to eliminating any of these. So it would be useful if we could get it in that form, Cindy.
While Cindy comes up, I might add to that, though, that those of us who've been through this fiscal process understand that what you mostly just get are vague responses about savings, especially when you're talking about the savings on the school district side. You know, we'll get an indeterminate. So it's hard to do a cost-benefit analysis when you get an indeterminate.
Mm-hmm. Co-Chair Wingard, Representative Dembro. As part of our process, we submit our fiscal statements to Legislative Fiscal Office, and they kind of combine those and issue one. I know that when we did the fiscal on Senate Bill 800, for example, we did it kind of mandate by mandate, and we'd be happy to share our, you know, individual fiscal with the committee, you know, during session. So,
any other questions? I'm going to close the public hearing on LC 253 and open a work session on LC 253. Co-Chair Gelser?
Yes, Mr. Chair, I would move that LC 253 be adopted as be introduced as a committee bill.
So Co-Chair Gelser has made a motion to introduce LC 253 dated 1/6/12 as a committee measure. Is there any discussion? Any objection? Motion passes. So I'm going to close the work session on LC 253 and open a public hearing on LC 291. Did you want to testify on this?
I can just explain it. Can I do it from here?
Yeah, go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So LC 291 is a bill related to the mandatory reporting of child abuse. I think everyone is aware of the unfortunate circumstances involving Penn State University this fall. And our universities, like those across the country, went back pretty quickly to look at what their rules were in relationship to reporting. I think many of us had assumed that our university system, our community colleges, were all incorporated in our mandatory reporting bill. As it turns out, they were not. And so what this bill does is it sweeps up employees of community colleges and universities, including coaches and music staff and others who also may be having children under the age of 18 in their classes, in the way that we're restructuring education into the mandatory reporter statute. And again, this doesn't require them to be able to determine whether something is abuse. Our mandatory reporting law simply requires that if you are a mandatory reporter and you suspect abuse, you report it
and then someone else figures that out. The bill addresses athletics and clubs in general as well, pulling in volunteers and youth organizations, narrowly those that have the care, control, and supervision of kids. So you're not talking about someone that is selling scrip or is kind of organizing the Girl Scout cookie drive. You're talking about that AYSO soccer coach. You're talking about that Girl Scout troop leader, that person that a parent is leaving the child with and is not going to leave until the parent comes back, the person that has that kind of responsibility around a child. The last thing that the bill does, it's an issue that has come up recently. We did some work, everyone remembers, a couple of years ago around sexual conduct in schools, and that had to do with incidents that took place between adults and students, but we didn't really address what happens when there is an event that occurs between students that needs to be reported that might be an incident of physical or sexual abuse. There has been some issue with how parents are notified that their children are caught up in that, either as an alleged perpetrator or as an alleged victim of that abuse, and this simply says that the parent of a child under the age of 12 would be notified that their child has been part of such an incident, whichever side of the abuse that they are on. They would not be disclosing the names of the other students, so you're protecting the confidentiality. But the idea is if your child has committed something that has been accused of doing something that if they were over the age of 14 would be a Measure 11 crime, you should know, so you can get your kid some help or work on that, and likewise if your child is alleged to be the victim.
Questions? Representative Conger?
So attorneys are mandatory reporters, and so the way that we deal with that in my profession is we take continuing legal education to help us understand what exactly that means. Because it's, you know, a lot of it's intuitive, and you would think that people would just do it. Some of it's not quite as intuitive, and there are some aspects that, you know, the education's helpful. So my question is twofold. One, so would this, like with volunteers and things like that, let's say in a, let's just say a volunteer setting, I don't necessarily want to define it more than that, they would become mandatory reporters. Does that extend liability to them then if they fail to report? And does it extend to the organization that is inviting the volunteers? Does it require them to educate their volunteers? I'm not making any value statement about whether that's good or bad. It's just a factual question.
I think that's a good question. They would be like every other mandatory reporter that is currently on the books, that if you have suspicion, you need to report. One of the reasons that this was narrowed, we had a similar bill a while ago, and it more generally hit all volunteers that worked with children. This was narrowed to those that have direct supervision and control of students, because those organizations typically are training because of those liability issues. For instance, my husband is an AYSO soccer coach. Before he goes out there on the field and gets responsibility of all those kids, they talk to him, they train him, not just about how do you run the drills, but how do you recognize a potential head injury? When do you call somebody in? Right. How do you handle difficult parents? So I think it would be folded in to that same type of thing. I think different professions handle this in different kinds of ways, certainly in the legal community through the CLE, and I've been to some of those. We have hours at the beginning of each session. Some professions don't do a big training. I think what's important to remember in the end is that we are not asking people to diagnose or determine abuse. It really is a good neighbor standard. If you suspect that a child is being harmed, you need to make the call and let somebody figure it out. And a great example would be child care providers. Private child care providers right now are mandatory reporters. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure what I don't think that there is a formal structure for someone that is providing child care, not as part of an organization, to do that.
So, may I follow up?
Yes.
Follow up very quickly. Do you know what the consequence is if you're a mandatory reporter and you fail to report?
I do not recall off the top of my head what the consequence is, but there is a difference between, I mean, you have to intentionally know and decide that you're not reporting to avoid that responsibility. If you're a mandatory reporter and you know a child that's being abused and you have no suspicion and you haven't reported, there is not something that's going to happen to you as a process. Unfortunately, what we do know is that child abuse remains grossly underreported, even among mandatory reporters. They hesitate to make reports. I'm sure that we've all had to make reports. I don't like making them when it's my turn to make the call. But unfortunately, we know what the consequence is sometimes when those calls don't get made.
That's right. Jim King.
I apologize. I was not expecting to. Jim King and I live in Camp Sherman, currently residing in Silverton. Real quickly, I'm with Occupy Oregon. We will be occupying the Capitol on the 1st of February. We will be getting you a book and a magazine about that whole thing. Soon, there's a book called This Changes Everything.
Jim, are you here to testify on this?
On the bill.
On the LC.
And let me speak to that, too. As a mandatory reporter, I appreciate the focus. I was involved with the occupation camp across the street, and at some point had to resign and leave that because of those witnessing the kind of problems you're talking about. I'm also a lobbyist with Darkness to Light, the gold standard foundation that has a program, Stewards of Children, which some of you are familiar with, for protecting kids from child sex abuse. As I did recently at the request of Senator Bates, a scan of a gap analysis of where you are, where you need to be, it seems like you've done a lot of the important infrastructure with the Senate Bill 379, mandating schools do training every year. And then in 557, last session, you did that mandating district attorneys put together a SART committee and medical facilities prepare people for forensic interviews. Interestingly, Medford and Bend are the only places that are doing squat to protect kids. OEA took 379, in my judgment, subverted it to protect their members, and that's their role, from liability. They train people with this kind of hokey thing online that covers their bases as teachers, because it covers their bases as liability, the teachers around the mandatory report thing. Oregon School Board Association did the same thing, as they should, protect their members. Medford and Bend are the only places that are worried about kids. And when I talked to Senator Bates, he suggested that we need to do a number of things, one of which we've talked about, getting the colleges and universities to begin to train undergraduates. And all the youth-serving professions, they should be being trained now. They're not. Secondly, we ought to mandate Stewards of Children, which is by far, it's won the 2008 the Crime Prevention Program of the Year. But giving districts an option of doing something else if they think they've got something better. But Stewards of Children, if you've seen it, it's a fabulous program. I'm 6 years at Western teaching teachers, 23 years at Chemeketa. I've never seen anything that even approximates the power of that 2.5-hour video. It has victims, giving victims voice about their experience, really powerful stuff. Experts, national experts, talking to our heads about what the data is, what the trends are. And what I liked especially is at the end they have probably the last third of that video, and I'm one of the certified trainers to do that sort of thing, is that they have specific suggestions that we adults need to be about. So Stewards of Children is the gold standard, if you will, of protecting kids from child sex abuse. Senator Bates asked me to get with his staff and get some language and begin to get that moving toward you. Michael and I have talked about higher ed and getting them involved in the undergraduate education. So you've done, I think, your part. We just need to close some gaps. And I apologize for not having it. I did the gap analysis the other night. I wasn't expecting to have this happen quite so quickly. So I've done some work. Happy to work with you. And I am available locally. And we'll look forward to talking to you again.
Representative Parrish?
Yes. Well, I have 3 kids in public schools that are not in Bend and Medford. I'd like to hear you articulate what you think is happening there that is not happening across all the other school districts in the state.
delicately. What's positive about Medford and Bend is they have quarterly campaigns to break down the code of silence. I'm in Silverton, and I go after putting together a domestic violence task force in the late 90s in Silverton, go away to Sun River and go off fly fishing and sailing in Mexico like retired people are supposed to do, right? Come back last spring, the domestic violence task force has been abandoned. The police have again imposed this kind of culture of fear, and the code of silence is again heavy on Silverton and Mount Angel. So what I like about Medford and Bend is they have regular campaigns. They have stuff going on all the time that deals with that. I think you could, for example, have a Nike has got some awkwardness, and the Catholic Church has some awkwardness right now. If we could get them to fund a statewide campaign for educating adults what we need to do to protect kids. Interestingly, teachers now are the number one recipient of kids' initial disclosure around sex abuse. Turns out that incident, that disclosure, is more important than the orientation to sex in the first place. Teachers have now surpassed parents as the initial, the recipient of that initial disclosure. It's hugely important that we say to kids, I believe you. How can I help? That needs to be the new default. I think it's an easy thing on a public service announcement to begin to coach parents to say, you know, or teachers and anyone to say, I believe you. How can I help? And I think you've created the infrastructure for help. I've not addressed it directly, but I would look to Medford. Marlena Mesh is the executive director of that program down there. I was just talking to Senator, Representative Buckley about getting her up and sharing the kinds of things they do in Medford.
Okay. Mr. King, thank you very much.
You bet. Look forward to being back a little better prepared.
See you the 1st of February.
Anybody else wish to testify on LC 291? So I'm going to close the public hearing on LC 291. And open a work session on LC 291. Co-Chair Gelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, I would move that the House Education Committee introduce LC 291 as a committee bill for the 2012 regular session.
So Co-Chair Gelson has made a motion to introduce LC 291 dated 1-9-12 as a committee measure. Is there any discussion? Any objection? So ordered. I'm going to close the work session on LC 291. I think we're done, right? Mm-hmm. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you very much for your patience, and we will see you all when the session begins, and we are adjourned.